This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
This is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Well, I hope that you will enjoy this particular episode. This has an unusual mark, number 666, which I am trying to emulate a little bit of the tongue-in-cheek type of satire they did with Genie Magazine many years ago with issue number 666, in which they had featured Max Maven as the guest in that particular issue. And this week, I thought, since we've already had Max Maven in episode number 600, which, by the way, if you haven't heard, I'd recommend you go back and hear what he has to say. But I thought we would bring another person from the Magic Castle, one who has been a longtime medium at the seances there at the Magic Castle, Mr. Rob Zabrecki. But before we begin, I want to thank each and every one of you for coming back from week to week and for enjoying this podcast and sharing this on your social media and letting other people know about this podcast. We have continued to grow, and we appreciate you joining the community that we have through our pod letter, which you can subscribe to at themagicwordpodcast.com, as well as our YouTube channel. There is Texas Magician. And I also want to thank the Friends of the Magic Word who make this possible. I've been traveling quite a bit here recently, and I have a little bit of catch-up to do, and I wanted to welcome some people who are the newest members in the Friends of the Magic Word who have recently donated or pledged to the podcast. First of all, we have Chris Morrison, who through PayPal gave a nice donation. Thank you, Chris, very much for your donation. Also, Mark Byrne had given a pledge through Patreon, so thank you for your monthly pledge. And then also Joyce Benjamin and Jesse Robinson gave an annual pledge through Patreon. If you're not familiar with the annual pledge, this is a way that you can help the Magic Word with your financial donation and still receive some pretty cool perks depending upon whatever level that you join. But by giving an annual pledge, you're charged up front for the 1 year and you're given a 10% discount. So you save some money and the Magic Word receives some money and you receive some perks, and it's a win-win for everybody all the way around. So if you have the ability or desire to pay on an annual basis, that is welcome then too, and you can check that out at patreon.com/themagicword, and it will tell you what perks you can receive at certain levels. And so I want to thank each of you four people for becoming Friends of the Magic Word. Thank you for your donations and pledges. As you can tell, it doesn't matter whether you're using Patreon or PayPal, you can make a pledge or donation either way. Speaking of Friends of the Magic Word, I want to thank John Gaspard, who is the author of the Eli Marks Mystery Series. And John has recently offered three copies of an ebook that he has recently completed, which is called The Self-Working Trick. Actually, it's a collection of a dozen Eli Marks short stories, 10 of which have never been published before. And I will tell you more about how that you can enter the contest. This is open to the world, since it is going to be an ebook that will be sent to you digitally. And I will tell you about that on the back end of the podcast. So please stay tuned at the back end and learn how you can enter this contest to win. It'll be running for the next couple of weeks. But let's introduce this week's guest. Rob Zabrecki is someone who has been working with the Magic Castle as a medium for the seance, as I mentioned earlier, for about over a decade. And he started out as a musician and then changed his career from music to magic. And he had a rather eclectic kind of interest in music, which seemed to translate easily, but not so easily, I guess, when he tried to find his character as this rather quirky, offbeat type of character that he presents himself on stage when he's performing. He has also, a year ago or so, started a series called The Other Side on YouTube, which I recommend if you go and do a search on YouTube, you will be glad you did. It's just a very cool video where he has some of his friends, like Jack Black and Jason Sudeikis, and several other people who are celebrities, who are musicians and actors, who join him. It's about an 8-minute video, each of these in this short series, and they take a ride to the other side. as the name implies. It's, again, kind of tongue-in-cheek, much like this episode then is as well. So that's something that he got into, and I'd recommend you take a look at over on his YouTube channel. Aside from that, he also has been involved with Brookledge Follies, which is something that's held on a regular basis at the Brookledge home where Erica Larson, who is the former Larson home where Erica still lives, and they have a lot of people who come in and experiment with different kinds of variety acts with music and everything, and he talks a little bit about that as well. And this week, we talk a little bit about spiritualism as well, since that is a religion that is still practiced in certain parts of not only this country, but the world. This is, I said, kind of an unusual episode, since it has an unusual mark, number 666. So I invite you to relax, and as you can, and enjoy this week's episode with Rob Zabrecki here on The Magic Word. Well, today is a very special episode. We are recording our 666th episode of the Magic Word podcast. And with that, I felt like we really needed to have someone who is extra special, kind of on the spooky side. And I think there is no one better, perhaps, than one who actually leads the seance at the Magic Castle, plus has done a lot of other things, including like The Other Side, which is a great YouTube video series. We'll get into all that. Plus, even is a member of a band, used to be in a band, but still is another one called The Unholy Three. This is great. I've really been looking forward to this for a long time. I'm so glad we can welcome him to the Magic Word. Please welcome Rob Zabrecki. Hey there, Rob.
Hi, Scott. How are you? Thanks.
I'm fantastic, nice, especially now that I'm here, get a chance to chat with you. So I had mentioned about the Unholy Three, by the way. That was kind of an offshoot because I know that without going back into all of your history, I know of you doing music beforehand and having different groups and then kind of migrated into magic. But you've always still can maintain that interest in punk rock mainly, I guess, or what kind of genre?
All genres. I'd say rock has been probably the main blanket way to express my love for music, especially what I've put into magic, and some avant-garde and experimental music has played a key role in helping shape some of my routines and, you know, using as background and sometimes even silent pieces I like to do to music that's probably not super popular.
You mean kind of like, I guess, the early David Byrne stuff, I guess, when he was with the Talking Heads, and they were, I thought, pretty avant-garde for the time. Devo and others like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those are good examples, because those people, they were so unique in what they were doing. They had a very singular vision, and they drew from things not everybody was drawing from, so it kind of put them in their own place. So although I wouldn't say I'm a direct line to, you know, maybe Devo or the Talking Heads, I like the more the philosophy that they used in a kind of do-it-yourself, more of a punk ethos than anything, you know, thinking for yourself and just not worrying about whether someone's going to so much like it or not, but just following your vision.
Right. I think there is an interesting overlap with music as being as art, as well as performing art, because you're not just performing on stage with music, but you have particularly when you have an audience, so you're doing a live show. There is a performance art along with that. Of course, when you're recording, you're getting into the music, I'm sure. But am I right? Do I understand what I'm talking about? Does that make sense?
Well, yeah. I mean, if you're recording music, it's an audio experience. You know, you're conjuring up images in your mind of what the music looks like, and that's going to be different for everybody. Or you see a music video and you can sort of get an idea of what the band looks like or something. But in magic, it's much more because it is visual, but there's also an audio aspect to it, and so there's many different forms at play. And I think magic is best performed in person. So that even puts it on the stage, right? Being there among other people and having this more ephemeral experience as opposed to just putting on a set of headphones, listening to your favorite, you know, Rolling Stones record or whatever.
Well, that's a good point. And what do you draw on as far as your muse, if you will?
That depends. Every project, every idea comes from somewhere different. There's not one well, I would say. It depends on what, it kind of boils down to wants and needs, you know. A bunch of years ago, I wanted a piece of my act about regret. I just kind of thought this, I was working through something. I thought, well, this would be a nice gap in my, this will really feel something personally, and it'll help shape my sort of longer hour, Zabrecki hour show. So I found things that would make sense to perform for an audience that had a theme of regret. And then I married it to a magic trick, and I put some music to it, and I ended up shaping this whole little experience that satisfied me artistically and was also something that it turned out people liked to watch and thought was funny. And, you know, there was plenty of ways to sort of mask the real feelings of regret with more of an artistic, you know, more of a dreamlike way to get into that world.
Do you kind of feel also it's important to let the audience into your world and know you as opposed to look at the pretty thing kind of a thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the whole point of it, is that there's a point of view, whether it's my point of view or a character that I've dreamed up's point of view, those lines are a little bit blurry. But yeah, I think that's why I was drawn to magic, was because it was a form of self-expression.
As music is as well, I would think.
Yes.
Yeah. And in creating some of those things, I'm sure it just takes a long time to kind of work it out. And it's nice that you would have the Magic Castle as a venue where you can go and work out some things from time to time. Is that true? Is that where you kind of get to work things, or where do you actually go?
Oh, definitely. I mean, without the Magic Castle, I wouldn't have had, it's impossible to went where I went without having that great place to go to every Friday to head down to the basement and try out, you know, whatever idea that I thought was interesting enough to try out and put forth in front of an audience and fail for, you know, a couple of years before it actually clicked and it worked into some kind of a, you know, viable routine that I liked and the audiences were responding to. So I think I was really fortunate. Most magicians, of course, don't have that. Most musicians don't have a place where they can go and play every Friday night. I mean, some do, but generally speaking, you know, you ramp up towards a gig, and then you do that gig, and you figure out your notes afterwards, and then you do the next one a week, a month, 6 months later. So the progress is generally slow. That's been my experience. But in my case, going up to the castle every Friday was an amazing opportunity to. You know, present magic in the best way possible, because people are dressed up, you're in this Victorian house. It's like, it's hard to top that as far in magic, at least for an environment to.
And people come there to see magic as opposed to going up to their table at a restaurant, hey, pick a card kind of a thing you're imposing. Whereas here at the castle, people will come to see you and to see magic. They come knowing what to expect, I guess, if you will.
Precisely. Yep. Mm-hmm.
When do you feel as if that you have it down and or else you're going to toss it out? When you're working on material, I think this is a key question here. I'm thinking about David Copperfield, for example, and his Alien. He'd been working on that for a while. It didn't work, if in his opinion, and the audience kept. Anyhow, he still has it in his act. But for a long time, he just had to keep massaging that. But he knew there was something there. And I wonder how many times you might be discouraged when you've been working on something. And you think, okay, I know there's something there. The audience is, I think it's the audience, not me. Let me try it again next week with a different audience, same routine. Well, that's not working. Let me tweak this or that because I have a belief in this piece that it would work. At what point, if any, do you have material in which you say, this isn't going to work? I need to either toss it. I've adjusted it all I can, and I think it just isn't going to work.
That's a great question. I think that the answer is different for each routine. I failed and continue to fail so much in magic that I have a name for my failures. I call them art tears. Hmm. And they're not the tears you cry when you lose a pet or a loved one or something like that, or your car gets, you know, stolen. It's the kind of tears that when you've worked on a center tear for 3 months and it's just not hitting, whether it's your handling, whether it's the moment that you're looking up and doing the move, it's just off by, you know, a couple minutes where everybody's catching you and you're getting caught, or the script's off, or whatever, you know, it can be a million different things that you just have to let go and cut your losses and move on and add up what you've learned from that before you do. So you go, well, okay, I I'm not going to do this. You know, this is my idea for, you know, let's call it the alien or whatever. And I put it in and I'm working on it. It's just not happening. It's not hitting. And you're brainstorming. And in my case, I get feedback from friends and colleagues saying, well, what's good about this and what's not good about it? Why isn't it connecting? Because I'm not seeing it. I think very few magicians can see it. You need someone you need guidance. You need trusted friends and colleagues who are going to say, look, this isn't working for you. And here's why, right? Because we're in our bodies, we're in our minds, we're seeing through this very specific lens of like, well, it looks good to me. I don't know. I don't get what's going on. I think this story is fine. I think it matches with this magic effect. I don't get it. So at the point where you let go of it, that's it's the send off. It's the art tears. And I think I found a way to find happiness in that now, going, well, hey, I got to work with, say, Brian Gillis on this amazing move, and I got to see how he did it, and I got to study six different methods of this, and maybe it's not going to work for me now, but I got to learn some magic principles, and through it was a valuable experience. And I think, you know, as magicians, we fail a lot. It's you know, you see what's on we all see the end result of what's on stage for, I don't know, now it's more of, we see it more of a, in see plenty of videos of people's performances on, you know, Penn and Teller or, you know, Fool Us or their performance of the Magic Castle or whatever they're doing. So we kind of see the polished end all result. What we don't see are the, you know, many, sometimes hundreds, sometimes thousands of hours of, you know, artist development and back behind the scenes stuff that didn't work. So, you know, I think it's important to know that you're going to fail. I'm going to continue to fail. There's things that I'm working on right now that are probably not going to work out in the future. But it's all about the ride. I think it's about, you know, the journey and in loving what I do. I don't mind if something doesn't work out. I go, that's okay. Like I'm fine with it.
I think failure is part of success. You're not going to be successful unless you have had a few failures. Everything can't work out perfectly all the time, certainly. And so I think it's important to learn from those mistakes and to certainly grow and to move on. So, yeah.
Yeah. And to have fun with the fail. I mean, and to like, I think to address failure is something it's part of the joy of it. Like you have to know that's going to be a part of it. And I think people get frustrated and, you know, or they don't take people that aren't good listeners, that don't want to accept, you know, opinions that from, you know, again, and I say trusted friends and colleagues and close ones, you can't just, you know, anyone's going to have an idea about what your magic act should be. And oftentimes they do give you those opinions, but you have to narrow the focus of who you're going to listen to and really define that. And then once you do that, when those people are offering information, you've got to listen and you've got to be able to go, okay, I'm stubborn and I think that maybe they might be wrong, but they might be right, and I'm gonna exhaust this idea until, you know, I see it through a different lens. So
yeah, I think you have to have that persistence. And also I think you had another key point there of getting that outside viewpoint. A lot of times we are just seeing ourselves and thinking, nope, you know, that this is good, I believe in it, and someone else is saying, they might help you adjust it, but before long saying, nope, this just isn't going to work, or it's not your character. And so, yeah, having a few trusted friends who can help out, I think that's important to tell you when to stop also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And maybe it's not a friend. Maybe it's somebody who's not going to try to find a warm and fuzzy way to say, that's terrible, take it out. But you hire a director and they don't have a horse in the race in that way. So they're going to say, look, this isn't working, and here's why. So I think, you know, you got to have a thick skin for this stuff, because, you know, we can all lay in our beds at night and dream about how great something's going to be. And it's got this fantasy version of how amazing it's all going to be from beginning to end, this flawless piece of art.
Now, one important thing I have learned from so many people over the years and the different episodes of the podcast, and that is of developing a character, because once you have a character, as you do, then you can write for that character more easily. This is how this person would react in this situation. And so that way, whenever you are developing a routine for an act, you can plug and play and it stays the same character, as opposed to doing something and all of a sudden, like in your case, you start doing something wacky and crazy that is outside of your character. Although it's a great routine, it's just not you. Do you find there are new things you're working on for your character that are easy to put in, or do you reject some things saying, man, that's great, but it's just not me?
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the more you, the further you are down the road of having a fully formed, you know, character or persona, you know, right away, it's just, you know, the taste, you know, the feel, you know, the vibe of what's going to fit in that world and what's not. So it's very easy to make those decisions early on. Not so much. I mean, that's what the whole, I think discovering that is a fun journey in its own. So, and you get to a point where once it's defined, I think you save a lot of time and you just know it. It just becomes innate.
I'm curious about how you actually found your character. For an example, in talking with Jeff Hobson about how when he was doing this gay type of character, he was in a biker bar or a club one night, or he had said some funny line and responding to being gay or something, and he was just getting a lot of good response, and one thing kind of led to another. Was there an epiphany moment, or was it something that was hard for you to try to work on to get to this character?
There was an epiphany, I would say, when I was very early on, late 90s, I'm at the Magic Castle. I'm trying to figure out how to be a magician and reinvent myself in magic. And I'm not taking to it well, Scott. It wasn't like I just strolled in and was able to, you know, flawlessly do this stuff. I was terrible. And there were people alive to say, yeah,
he was terrible.
he was really, really, really bad. And he should have bailed out when he had the chance. But I was trying, and I was really trying to figure out whether it was card tricks or close-up magic or stage magic or parlor, or was it comedy, or was it straight up mentalism? I was like, just trying. I was like, I wanted it so bad. I was trying everything and nothing was really working. And then there was a time when I was living in Silver Lake with my girlfriend, who's now my wife. And I was kind of like, you know, dancing around the house on a Sunday afternoon in my underwear, and I'm goofing around, and I was doing God knows what, and she stopped me. She's like, that's it, it's that. If you can perform magic through that lens, it'd be really funny and interesting. And I kind of looked at her, and then it all kind of made sense, not realizing it was going to have the life that it did, but going, oh yeah, that's why not try this? And so then the next Friday I went to the Magic Castle, and it was very, you know, something that was very kind of a little more stoic, the pauses were bigger than surprising things would happen in a wild dance at the end of the show.
Right.
To contrast all that stillness. And then suddenly the three tricks that I was doing with under that, you know, the guise of that, the parameters of what I just described, it worked. And audiences were compelled and they were laughing and they wanted to go on that ride with me. So that was the beginning of it. And from there, it was just like just refining this, you know, this sort of idea of what a what that character could be.
Now, moving then on into like the seances and things like that, did you start working at the seance room there at the castle first, or did you start doing some of the YouTube seances earlier?
Well, I started doing the Seance of the Magic Castle first.
Okay.
About 10 or 12 years ago now, I started filling in for Leo Koska, who's been performing them since, you know, I think the early 83, I think 1983. And so I'd fill in for Leo, and, you know, one seance led to, I don't know, 250 or something like that. I've performed an awful lot of them. So those were, you know, something that I was interested in, spirit magic, spirit theater, early works of, you know, Eugene Berger and Tony Andruzzi and like that. Really fascinated with the world of spiritualism and seances. And I just was really taken by that idea of spirit magic. So that developed over time. I started doing more and more of them. And then at the same time, I thought, you know, I've been performing this magic character for 15 years, and I was always under the idea of, this is meant to be on stage, it's meant to be for a live audience. What would it look like if we put it on, you know, on television, or, you know, if we taped it and it was on, whether it be YouTube or, you know, Hulu, it was just, we wanted to see what it looked like in this box.
Right.
So that led, exactly. So that led to the other side with Zabrecki indirectly, but it got us there. And so we decided to have a seance show where I could invite guests in my house and they could contact a spirit of their choice. And we could sort of put filters on what the Zabrecki world would look like to an audience, which was really fun because we did it ourselves. So we got to, you know, write, produce, and I say we, my wife and I, we created and basically did it together. And so got to write, produce, direct, act, you know.
And you put the whole thing together, you edit, you do the post and everything as well, and music. And
we had a friend come in who helped us, who was a very talented editor, and he was able to kind of help. Like I would describe something and he would say, what about this? And he would pull up examples, and we started doing these collages and started that process. And then we built a model for the first episode, which was with Jason Sudeikis, who came over, and we contacted the spirit of Pistol Pete Maravich, the basketball legend. Mm-hmm. So we created this sort of model of like what the title credits look like and how we would move from one thing to the other and holding hands and drifting off to the afterlife and then actually talking to this spirit that you want to talk to. So by creating this model, we're able to kind of copy that and use that for a style guide for the rest of the episodes.
And what is, I keep forgetting, what's the word when you have that, it's not mucus, but the white stuff that seems like it's coming out of your nose and everything. What's that called?
Ectoplasm,
thank you. Just set my mind over there. Those kinds of things. Yeah, the production, I think, is great. Now, and the friends also, Jason Sudeikis and Jack Black and some of the other people who are musician artists, are they all friends of yours or someone that you had contacted? Or
certainly, yeah. I mean, I'm from LA and had, as we mentioned, I had a previous life in music. So I've kind of, I knew Jack through music. I met him in the late 80s. We were 21, I think.
Was that back when he still had his group?
He hadn't had his group yet. He was a UCLA student.
Oh, wow.
And was like a college DJ and just kind of hanging around some of the same art circles and things like that, music worlds. So I was familiar with, you know, Jack and some of the others through my career as a musician, and then some of them through my life in magic. So when it came down to doing it, we realized let's get some really fun kind of showbiz friends to come on who people would recognize, and it would, you know, widen the net a little bit for the audience. But they're all people that we really liked and respected and wanted to, you know, see who they would contact. And it was a really fun collaborative process to make those things. So I would say it was a combination of people that I knew through music and magic.
You were putting those out about once a month or so for a while. It's been about a year, I guess, since you've last put one out, or how long?
Yeah, we wrapped it up. I mean, I think I think we wanted to do a season where there's, you know, 13 seemed the obvious choice to stop the season. And we talked about doing the second season. There were, for what they are, for the 7 or 8 minute videos that they are, they're a lot of work. And it was very time.
I can tell.
Very labor intensive. So I think we decided to kind of let go of the idea of doing it because, again, it was everyone's working for free and it was a labor of love. And although they were really fun and we could have done a second season and made some changes and maybe made it, you know, tweak different things here and there, I'm proud of it. I'm happy that we did it.
They were great.
And the goal was to make, again, to create this, to take the character out of the, you know, the stages of, you know, magic festivals and conventions of the Magic Castle and see what it looked like on camera. And we did it. So, you know, kind of like, it was like mission complete, very happy to look back on those. And I chuckle every time, you know, I look at them and I'm proud of them in that we got to, we really covered all aspects of, there was no outside person saying, this is going to be your walk. You know, we created everything. Wow. And that was something that I'm really happy about because you don't have a lot of control. If you're an actor in a film, you don't choose the movie credits. You don't choose the music behind you. You don't choose the other actors you're working with. If you work on a magic festival or convention, you're not picking the MC that for that night. You're not picking the color of the curtain. But when you shoot a seance in your living room, you can, all those ideas are all yours for better or for worse. And I think that makes me really happy to know that like we were able to accomplish that.
Yeah, and doing it in black and white, of course, was perfect then as well. Did you have enough views that you could actually monetize that on YouTube?
God, no. Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, no. I mean, I'll tell you, we knew going into it, it was going to be a almost a joke for ourselves and for our friends, because it was so non-commercial. The music that we chose, none of it had, say, commercial appeal. Some of the guests are, you know, commercially known, but it was always strictly for ourselves, knowing that it was going to be a very sort of niche thing. And believe me, I had agents and managers saying, you can get Jack Black on your show and this is the show you're making.
Yeah.
So it was kind of a funny in that way that it was so, you know, as non-commercial as it ended up being.
One of the things also about that, of course, you're dealing in the spiritualism, and I was, I've been talking with some different people about spiritualism apparently that is not just was a religion, but still is. And talking to Doc Hilford, for an example, Doc has said, yeah, that there are spiritualist churches and places where people can go. Have you gone, or I mean, how much in-depth research have you done, I guess, on spiritualism?
As much as I can. I mean, I'm fascinated by it. And yeah, it's an ongoing thing. You become almost a student of this stuff. Mm-hmm. I visited a spiritualist church in Lancaster, California, about an hour from here. It was amazing.
What was that like?
Completely far out. It was amazing. I loved it. I had a great experience.
Did it seem like it was a show almost or something? Or they have a preacher or they sing? I mean, I only know regular church services.
All of the above. Yeah.
Wow.
It was a house of belief. There's a spiritualist community on the East Coast called Lilydale.
Yes.
And it's just, you know, I'm sure a lot of the viewers and listeners will know about Lilydale. Those of you that don't, it's a community, is it Maine? It's somewhere up there in the northeast.
I thought it was in Florida. Is it in Maine?
No, it's, yeah. I believe
definitely
it's
northeast.
Northeast. Okay. And so this is a community of spiritualists and gypsies and people of that nature who mm-hmm. you can walk on the grounds and go see a number of people and contact, you know, grandpa or your, or maybe a pet. I don't know. You decide.
And you've been there too? You've been there?
No, I haven't, but there's a wonderful documentary about it called No One Ever Dies at Lilydale that I've watched. And there's a book, it came out in the late 70s, early 80s, a hardcover book on Lilydale. So, and they recreated the Fox sisters' house there, which burned down, which was in upstate New York. It burned down after they left, and then they I believe they recreated it to scale on Lilydale property. So it's kind of the hub. If you want to, you know, dive into that world, I think that's a great documentary to see.
Was that on Netflix or what was that?
I don't remember what it's on. I'm not sure. It's out there though.
What's it called again?
No One Ever Dies at Lilydale.
Okay. Hmm.
Yeah. But there's so much, I mean, there's so much great information just on the internet about spiritualism and, you know,
it's just that today a lot of people think of that as being an old thing, like Houdini's time when he was busting spiritualists and everything, because after World War II or World War I, people were wanting to contact their lost husband or son or whatever and started getting into all that, and they were taking people's money. So it seemed like it was a wave, I guess, and that had died out. And that's what I want to kind of bring up, I guess, is the fact that not completely hasn't died out. There are still believers and churches and all this. Certainly not to the extent, I guess, popularity or notoriety of what it was back in the 20s, let's say, but still around.
Oh, yeah, it's still around. I mean, I think people want to believe.
Sure. Yeah.
In the 20s, it was a fad. You know, it was a craze, that came and went. Primarily in America and in England, that these are the two countries that it was very popular in. But it you know, whether Houdini stood on stage and said, "Look, this is what these people are doing. These are the here's the flap of the spirit slate. Here is mm-hmm. the medium's grip. Here's how this stuff works. Here's a spirit rod. We're going to tap somebody, you know, exposing these people one after the other. Marjorie, right? The Witch of Lime Street." et cetera, et cetera. This, you know, he did everything he could to say this stuff is fake, but yet people want to believe, and they still do. And I doubt that's ever going to change.
No, I agree. And I want to talk about seances, about people believing when you do this at the Magic Castle. But I was thinking about to say also, I believe it was one of the theories I'd heard of the person who had punched Houdini was set up by Marjorie or some of the spiritualists who were wanting to take him out, I guess, basically. That was just a theory I'd heard about why he was killed.
I never heard that. And from what I learned about the guy, his last name was Godhead. He was a friend of this writer for a college paper, and he showed up he was tagging along basically while his buddy was writing an article for the Canadian college newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so he was I think he was a little bit off, this fella. And he said, he asked him the one question, is it true you could take a blow to the stomach? Houdini said yes. And then on the offbeat, he, you know, threw his punch. He threw a punch there, which was kind of, and then after after Houdini's passing, the guy, the man was very reclusive. He never talked about it. And I think he was, I don't think he was put up.
You don't think he was set up?
Makes
for a good story.
It makes for a good story, but I, out of respect to what I've learned about him, I would say he probably would not have taken the bait from somebody who's going to offer him $100 to do that. I mean, I don't know. I wasn't there.
I think his name, that does ring a bell, Whitehead or something like that.
Whitehead. Yeah. Yes. It's been a while since I've looked him up, but yeah.
And then going back to the seance, particularly at the castle, because people come to seances with their own belief system. I did seances with Jamie Salinas here in Houston for 8 years during the month of October each weekend. And people would come in with their own beliefs, whether they believed in wanting to talk with someone on the other side. Some people were skeptics and some people were just there for a good time. And so we had decided early on not necessarily to try to be a person who through whom the dead can speak, but we were just going to be basically ghost hunters, if you will, as well. I mean, we were just as interested to find out whether something is out there or not. We'll just give it a try and see. So how have you developed your character? Are you a medium or a ghost hunter, or exactly what is your character?
Well, in the Houdini seance room, I'm a spirit medium, and it's I straight up say tonight's seance will be similar to one that you might have seen between the years, you know, 1875 through 1925. So they know that I'm guiding them down this path, that I'm sort of, I don't want to say a Civil War reenactment, but along the lines of that sort of, this is what you might have
seen. In the ilk of.
And I never once say that I'm a believer, because I'm not a believer at all. But I act as one would, as I tell them. I play the role that I tell them I'm going to play, and I repeat the lines, if you believe you will receive. Those are some of the things, you know, that was one of the mantras, slogans, whatever that mediums were saying back in the day.
Yeah, we always begin our seance, for those who believe, no explanation is necessary, for those who don't know, no explanation will suffice.
Yeah, and that pretty much, right? Yeah. That old Dunninger quote is so great. I love that. I love that one. So good.
And so do you have people afterwards? I assume you do, who will say to you, hey, I need to talk to somebody, or can you tell me who's going to win the Super Bowl, or that kind of thing?
I do.
How do you deal with that?
I run.
I run.
Try to get down to the valet and get back to my house and just forget that it happened. Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing to me. People want to believe so bad sometimes that they just, you know, even though they've just been on this ride that feels like a Disney ride in a way, right? Because it's this immersive thing, and there's voices coming through speakers, and there's apparitions that are, you know, performed through like Pepper's Ghost illusions and things.
Right.
I think everybody knows that it's not what they're in a room that's set up, right? So afterwards, for them to sort of put all that aside and say, well, I know that was fake, but can you come over to my place and bring up Uncle Eddie? You know, it's just, I know I kind of don't get it because I, again, I'm not doing seances in my house for fun. I think it's, they were comical to a degree, and they were, horrible to other degrees, you know? So like, this is something that I don't, I'm fascinated by it, but it's like, it's almost like watching a documentary about, you know, serial killers or the Manson family or something. You're like, wow, what was this? What were these people thinking?
You've seen Nightmare Alley, I assume?
Not the new one. No, not yet. I will.
Yeah, the Guillermo del Toro. You did see the old black and white. Was that 1936, I believe? That's available on YouTube. You can watch the old one on there.
Oh, yeah.
So I watched that first and then just recently saw the new one. And that's one of those things that kind of reminded me when you were talking about the fact of doing the spook show. In other words, he's doing mind reading and everything. And then someone comes to him and says, can you come to my house and let me talk to my wife or whatever. And then things go bad. So it's, yeah, there are people who do believe, who do are looking for answers wherever and however they can, and trying to find someone to come and help them reach out. So I think that would be fairly difficult. I remember going to the first time I went to the Magic Castle back in 80 was or something like that. And Francis Willard was working with Glenn Falkenstein and they were doing their spirit cabin. And then he was doing his blindfold act with the metal shield and everything. But what I remember most is after it was over and people were leaving the theater, that Glenn went over to Stray's Ride over by the stairs there, and people were lined up and they were asking him questions about their job. I mean, just everything. I mean, there must have been 10 or 12 people, I guess, who were lined up. I mean, not everybody was waiting, and he was talking to people. I don't remember what advice I didn't know him or anything at the time. I just thought, that's really interesting that he would do that. Not it something that you do.
No.
Like you say, I run,
and then if I encounter someone later, they're usually surprised that the off character person that they meet is not, you know, the person who you know guided them to the seance or, you know, whatever.
Now, the people who have been the mediums, the seance before, I remember Steve Spill's father, Sandy Spill, I believe it was he the original one?
I believe Sandy was the second medium. It was Francis Carlyle and then Sandy Spill, and that led into his last name is escaping me. That led to Leo, and then eventually Leo, and Leo brought me on, Leo Koska.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting, I think, is how the medium lasts so long. I mean, there wasn't just like for a year or so. They kind of, I mean, in the 60-year history, there have only been less than a half dozen.
I know it's really interesting, and it's a miracle and amazing. I'm always surprised that I've done them for, you know, coming up on 12 years.
12 years, wow.
Mm-hmm. That's not every night. I mean, look, I have many other, you know, there's many other things that I do in life, and it's
sure.
It's there's not seances every single night.
They call you in and say, "Hey, we got a group tonight," or you just
No. So they book them in advance, and there's plenty of time out to sort of, you know, fix this, you know, adjust schedules and things to make them work. Mm-hmm. But yeah, let's say a few. There's been a few a week. It's ramping back up since the room reopened. A lot of people are interested to see this new version of of the seance room. So there's. It's and as people are going out more these days, it's becoming a little bit more, it's more busy.
Did things change electronically after the fire some years ago? Or
no.
Was that room affected by the fire?
Strangely, the Magic Castle almost caught on fire. The one room that was not affected by any of it, the Houdini Seance room.
Now that is weird.
It is weird. It's what's weird is that combined with the theme that year was Inferno. I don't know if you're, it's 2011 and each Halloween has a theme.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Like this. Yeah. Dante's Inferno. I think this year.
Exactly. It was, that was Dante's Inferno 0.20 or something like that. But the original one was 2011. And that year, that was the year that it, you know, caught ablaze and was down to the house because of the sprinklers did more damage than the actual fire. Fire was primarily on the roof. Some roofers came and they were putting molten goop on there, and a piece fell into the attic, and it started up. Luckily, fire department got there very quickly, but it was the sprinklers that damaged a lot of the artwork and carpets and sort of wood and things like that, and sort of some of the frame pieces. But don't ask me why. Please answer him unscathed.
But I will ask you this. I won't ask you about that, but I will ask you about what weird things have happened over the last 12 years. I mean, in the 8 years we were doing, because we only did it on 1 month out of the year. You do it throughout the year. Over a period of time, there has to be some things that are coincidental that are beyond the scope of just being a coincidence.
No.
Good answer. Okay. Nothing out of the ordinary nor supernatural. Fair enough. Anyone
can get spooked in the dark. And sure, if the lights are out and I'm walking out, I almost trip on a cord, I can attribute that to something supernatural. But no, I haven't had any experiences that have. I would close to go on record on saying that I had a ghost.
I just wondered if they had. Had anyone told you in advance who would have been your predecessor or someone who had come in saying, well, I experienced, some people come in with certain belief systems that this is really real. And so they want to come back again because, oh, last time I was here, something different happened.
Or whatever. Oh yeah. All the time. And those are the people that, you know, if you believe you will receive, well, they believe. And so when the lights go out, you can start feeling all kinds of things. People, the lights come up in the seance room. People say, I felt someone tap my shoulder and, you know,
sure.
I think, you know, if you want that to happen, things like that to happen, they will.
Well, yes, exactly. You can also implant those kinds of thoughts before they even leave. Like with this place we have where we work is there's a creaky old staircase to get up there. And we talk about this prostitute who had died there, long story anyhow, that you might feel this icy touch of a person pushing you or tapping on the shoulder. So be careful when you're walking down the steps, because some people have fallen feeling as if someone has pushed them. So be sure and hold a handrail. And then later someone will say, yes, I thought I did feel someone. There was no one behind me because I've implanted that thought, you know?
Yeah, of course. That's that, all that stuff. I mean, there's so many psychological aspects to that. Sure. And once you lose your vision and lights go out and you're amped up and you're psychologically prepared to have this experience. Yeah. Things are going to happen.
You're looking for something then to happen too. Taking this just a step further. I've never been to the Brookledge Follies. I understand you've performed there several times. Tell me something about that and where it is, what happens and some of the people who are there.
Of course. Yeah. So the Brookledge Follies, is a variety show. It's an invite-only variety show that takes place in an antique theater about 2 miles south of the Magic Castle in Los Angeles. It's the Larson home, which was originally the home of Floyd and Jenny Thayer, the famous magic manufacturers and creators. So Floyd Thayer had bought the house in the late 20s and then built this antique theater in his backyard in the early 30s, and it was the showroom. It was a very large showroom with a big stage. And on that stage, they would perform larger, you know, stage illusions, and magicians would come in and there was a counter and you could buy whatever was coming out, whatever.
So it was a magic shop as well.
It was a magic shop. Yeah. And this was, and people like, you know, you had everybody from Orson Welles, Rita Hayworth going and performing there on the stage. There would be performances and gatherings. It was it was a mecca for magicians in LA before the Magic Castle. So the Floyd and Jenny thought it was haunted, and they swapped deeds with the Larsons, who lived in Pasadena, because the Larsons were in the magic world. Of course, William Larson Sr. was a magic attorney. It was an attorney / magician, magic attorney. There's no such thing as that.
A lot of money in that.
Yeah. So anyways, they switched deeds and the Larsons moved into the house. So before the Magic Castle, this was the place that magicians would go. So 1963, the Magic Castle opens, and the Larsons still live in this, you know, live in this house, Brookledge. It's called Brookledge because it's in an area of LA called Brookside, where there's a little river that runs through the backyard. There's a beautiful there's a beautiful bridge that goes over this. It's a nice little, it's more of a creek than a river, but it's a very, very beautiful neighborhood and sort of near Hancock Park, where a lot of the movie stars in LA live. It's a very kind of fancy neighborhood. And so I became friends with Erica Larson 20, 25 years ago. And 10, 12 years ago, there was, she's living at Brookledge and we're there, and started talking, and we said, hey, let's put on a variety show. Let's invite some of our friends and do a variety thing. I had a background in music, and so I thought we could really craft a really fun show. So we brought in, Tina Linder played the harp for some stuff, and we had a theremin player come in, our buddy of ours, the theremin, and people, rock groups, would come in and do a stripped down version of just to play a few songs on acoustic guitar, and then we'd have a magician, and then a juggler, and all these great
variety artists, basically.
Yeah, and magician, certainly with an emphasis on magic. That's always been, I think honoring the legacy of what the place was there for, the Thayer and the Larson, that all that magic had to. I think there was always some two or three performers that would be doing some kind of magic effects, and I would always push for someone to do an old magic trick, was Blue Phantom or something that we might have seen back in the day.
Right.
Because here in this antique theater, it's an incredible place to perform magic, or anything for that matter. So we did one. 100 people showed up. It was magical night. It was fantastic. Boy, let's do another one a few weeks later. And next thing I know, it evolved into what became the Brookledge Follies. And Erica has been an amazing, generous, amazing person. I love her to death. She's like a sister to me. And just made this, she opened up her house once a month for these things to happen. And it's taken its own.
Once a month? They do that monthly?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was an annual thing.
So summer months, winters would go dark. and there's been times where it's been close to renovations and things like that. And there's definitely been some darker periods, but yeah, in the summer it's like once a month, and it's some of the most fun performers who normally no one gets paid. It's people do this for the love of it's performers performing for performers. So I kind of lucked into it because just knowing Erica and just kind of pitching this idea early on, saying, "Hey, well, let's do something together." So I got to host a lot of those shows, and we actually did a spook show 10, 12 years ago. There, we did an actual spook show like you might have seen in the 1930s, where there was an actual blockout, lights went out, and there was a gorilla on the loose, and there was a chainsaw, and kind of went into this blockout where apparitions went flying all over the room.
And some phosphorescent stuff that was glow in the dark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we really tried to do a straight up lo-fi spook show that you would have seen, back in the days, Elwin and people like that, which was so much fun. And getting to collaborate with, some of my good friends in magic to make it as good as it could have been.
And how many people actually attend or are seated in the theater? I mean, like 100 people or 20?
Yeah. So it was 100. I think it's like 75 to 100. And we did maybe two shows a night for two or three nights, maybe two nights. So we ended up doing it four times. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Wow. Yeah. I'd heard about that. I never attended one, but I didn't realize it was a monthly thing, during the summertime, but like that was just a whole heck of a lot of fun.
It is a lot of fun. And the environment and the setting of going into this, you're in Hancock Park, so a lot of very, large Spanish and eclectic architecture, and you're on a residential street, and you walk through this, you walk up a side gate, and you kind of wander through this iron gate, and all of a sudden, you find yourself wandering into this beautiful garden. It's this beautifully manicured garden that feels
like Shangri-La.
It's just incredible, and there's little staircases that go here and there, and there's this little at the creek, and it's beautifully lit at night, and I've always found very kind of interesting, friendly people and lots of good conversations. People know it's a special thing. So they kind of like the Magic Castle. You kind of feel like, hey, I'm at a very interesting time and place in life. And I think everyone celebrates that together. And that's what gives the fuels, the energy of of those right. shows.
Man, that sounds so cool. Along that line, I was thinking about variety artists. And I was reading where just before Michael Jackson had died, you were invited to perform at a party for his son, Blanket. It was just you and a hula hoop artist and a juggler and no invited guests. Was yeah. that weird or is that typical? That just sounds weird to me.
It would have been weird even if it wasn't, you know, Michael Jackson and his yeah. kids. It was just a very bizarre event, which I was very close to not performing. It was a Saturday. I remember it being a Saturday afternoon and getting a phone call from a producer friend saying, hey, come on down. Got a gig, $500, do 10 minutes for a very small, intimate group. And it didn't sound, and I was a busy day. It was so last minute. I'm like, yeah, I don't think so. And he told me, it was Michael Jackson. And of course I had myself.
You said
available.
What time?
Exactly. I was just fascinated with his, you know, trajectory in art and in life, and was just like so obsessed with him, had been since really when like the Chimp came in, we started getting kind of like trippy. You know, I loved Off the Wall and some of those early records, but in early 80s, not as interested in like more like late 80s on up until he passed, which is such a far out person, you know, to me, character. And so
did you spend much time with him to get to know him as being that far out character?
God, no, I didn't meet him at all. I mean, I was ushered in, you know, I invited my wife with me. We get to the gate and they're like, they didn't let her in. Wow. When I got there, I thought it was going to be, there was 50 people outside of his house in Humbly Hills. I thought, oh, this is the party. There's going to be sure. you know, a couple hundred people there. And then they immediately said my wife couldn't come out. That was a red flag. Then they took my phone. That was a red flag. And then they put me in this like an exercise laundry room with these other performers. And they're like, you're going to walk down this little, you're going to walk down this grassy knoll here, and then you're going to make a right at the pool. And then there's going to be a little area with a few chairs, and that's the party. Okay. So then I had like a music cue. So I had somebody down there to kind of get that ready. And I remember people that you know, when the juggler and the hula hoop artist came back, they're like, that was really strange. But like, there was no time we weren't conversing. It was just like, that was bizarre. And like, you, Zabrecki, go. So I walked down, I'm going down this thing, and I'm like, okay, it looks like there's just a few, oh, interesting, not a lot of people. Okay, where's the party? And then in the pool, which was in a state of disrepair, this is some massive mansion not far from Hugh Hefner's house in sort of West Hollywood, going near, not too far from UCLA in LA, very fancy part of the city to live. And it was in a state of disrepair. They were renting this house, I guess, but there was like still Christmas decorations up, and it was like March or April. It was kind of like, well, this is not cared for, though. It wasn't manicured like you would expect the Jackson, mm-hmm. you know, from what you'd sort of seen and knew about this guy. And then there was this toy boat in the swimming pool, and it was just banging against the tiles in the pool repeatedly. And it occurred to me that it was like this, it seemed like this, the Peter Pan dream gone wrong to me, you know, because it was like all this wealth, but then in that Sunset Boulevard kind of way where it was just had this coat of dust on it. Right. I was like, this is so trippy. What does this mean? I'm like looking for the meaning in all this because I was so fascinated by Michael Jackson. So go down there and I do my 10-minute performance for, you know, Michael and Blanket. And there's helicopters flying over, distracted, which they had to like cover themselves every couple of minutes because they were so used to like, this is like something was going on at the Jackson house and the paparazzi was like on it.
Wow.
But only by overhead. Like they couldn't get on the property, but they could fly over.
Yeah.
So I did my bit, and I ended up doing this interpretive dance for Michael, and they were giggling, and they thought it was really funny. And
just 10 minutes is all you did, 10 minutes.
Yeah, 10 minutes, which ended up in this sort of dance routine, which I performed with the Diminishing Cards. And mm-hmm. they were amused by my, you know, stylings, because while Michael is such an incredible, gifted dancer,
right?
I intentionally try not to hit the one where, you know, I know where it's at, you know, I know where I can count and I've got a good sense of rhythm, but you know, it's kind of like going dancing in and out of that space. And they thought that was funny. I think they thought it was amusing. And it was very fun to dance for Michael Jackson. I got to say, it was cool.
That was pretty trippy itself.
It was trippy. And the music that I danced to was Thelonious Monk's Dinah, and Thelonious Monk's music is intentionally off. It falls. Sometimes it's behind, sometimes it pushes, but it feels a little loopy, a little drunk, if you will, you know, kind of like it's got its own sort of take, and dancing to that really will take you out of it. So at the end of it, I was able to like fulfill this weird, you know, dream that I would get to see this guy in person and see what his world looked like. And unfortunately it was a weird picture. You know, something I couldn't have imagined.
And so that was your one and only in and out experience, basically, in brush with Michael Jackson. Cause I know he had talked with so many other magicians, Franz Ferrari and others.
Yeah. Like, yeah, right. That was my only experience. And then he ended up, sadly, he passed, you know, a few months after that, and left those poor kids behind. It's just horrible to think that, you know,
sure. Yeah, on a completely different note. When you mentioned Thelonious Monk, it's funny. That's the second time that name has been invoked within the last week. I was at John Gaughan's house just earlier this week, and we were listening to some jazz, and we were talking about Dave Brubeck, and I mentioned Lionel Hampton, and also I said, you know, I'd love to have seen Thelonious Monk live. We were talking about that, and so then you mentioned Thelonious Monk again. It's like, wow, that's kind of surreal.
Well, I mean,
that's not a name that normally people throw out, you know.
yeah, maybe not. I mean, what a unique character. And for anybody interested in Thelonious Monk, I think there's a documentary which I haven't seen in 20, 30 years. I think it's called Straight No Chaser, is the name. And it's a really great look at what a absolute genius
he was.
Monk was. Man,
yeah. Incredible. Yeah. There were so many people who were great. I mean, I love jazz, you know, Stan Getz and so many others, Cannonball Adderley and whatnot. I mean, I was big time into that, all that, NM, loved that. It made me think also when you mentioned Hugh Hefner, because they would have Playboy's Jazz and Pop poll that was in the magazine each year. People would vote on what albums for the best of the year and all that. But so did you ever perform at Hef's house?
No, I never. I'd never been to the Playboy Mansion.
I talked with Michael Weber. He said he had performed for him once, and I thought that must have been an experience. I mean, we didn't get into any detail. It was just kind of like in passing as we were talking, and it just kind of name dropped. And I thought, wow, that had to be something.
Wow. Well, something for Hef, because Weber is such an incredible artist in his own right. And I think I love watching him perform. I think he's so engaging and cool. And I bet I can only imagine that Hef was like, in awe. Yeah.
Right. Well, listen, this has been a lot of fun, and it's great to hear the stories and stuff in the background and whatnot. So thanks, Rob, very much for being on here this week.
It was really fun, Scott. Thank you. You know, it's good to be here, and I enjoyed our chat.
Well, the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word Podcast. And so I always end by asking my guests, what is your philosophy of life? What's your word or words? I don't mean like abracadabra. I mean, like, what is it that motivates you and moves you each day and wants you motivate you to get up and move?
Well, I don't have a secret ingredients that's boiled down to a few words or a mantra. I can't pick between the Beatles or the Stones or tell you if it's oranges or apples, because every day my philosophy changes. But the one consistent thing that I've found is that I do things because they come from my heart, and I follow my dreams, and I don't quit, and I follow my own. You know, I follow my own light, and I try to make work that's provocative and interesting. And if people like it, that's great. And if they don't, that's fine too. And you get one life. So as far as I know, so I think you should try to do as much cool stuff as possible.
That's great. Yep. And following your dream, because you only live once. Great. Rob, thanks very much. It's been wonderful.
It really has. Thanks, Scott.
So with the Magic Word Podcast, that was Rob Zabrecki. This is Scotty out.
Thank you very much, Rob. We seem to have covered a lot of territory there in a short 1 hour. Thank you for your words and for a lot of insight we got into some of the things you're involved with, and it's quite fascinating. And you certainly do have quite a character that you develop for your onstage persona. And I challenge the listeners also to try to develop their own unique character and style then as well. Not to emulate yours, but to have one of their own, just as you have developed your own then as well. By the way, listeners, I do want to help Rob just a little bit to correct some of the things he had said regarding his predecessors who were at the Magic Castle as mediums. He had said Francis Carlyle. I know he misspoke, and what he meant was E. Raymond Carlyle. John Cox had helped me by doing a little bit of research on this real quickly. He had gone into Max Maven's history of this, and then was Sandy Spellman, and Ed Fowler apparently did seances at some point about 800, and Max Maven considered himself really as the backup medium. And also, Max said, the better part of 3 decades ago, I spent a few years as the club's backup medium, so I can say with firsthand knowledge that quite a few unexpected things have happened in that room. I would say that is to the opposite of what Rob had said. He, over the last decade, hasn't experienced anything. So apparently they did have some things happen prior to Rob being in there. Or did they? Well, anyhow, and also the person he was trying to think of as far as the mark was Mark Edward. And so Rob got back to me with that name of Mark Edward he was trying to think of. So that kind of completes that. And then it goes then to Leo Koska, who then went on to pass that on to Rob Zabrecki. So there you go. Well, I want to thank you guys again for listening to this episode. And I told you I was going to tell you how to enter the contest for a chance to win an ebook. And here's what you do. Just go to themagicwordpodcast.com, this week's blog, number 666, kind of hard to forget. And there you will see towards the bottom of that blog an entry form where you can fill in your name and email address, and it will automatically populate a spreadsheet. And at the end of 2 weeks, I will then randomly select 3 different names. And again, what you're going for is for one of 3 ebook copies of the new Eli Marks book, The Self-Working Trick. And this book is a collection of 12 of Eli Marks' short stories, 10 of which have never been published before. And the winners can pick their choice of ebook format, whether it's going to be Kindle, a Nook, a Kobo, Apple, or Google Play. So you can let John Gaspard know if you are a winner, which format you want, and he will send that to you. And so there again, it's open to the world. So there you go. Just go and check that out. Be sure to sign up for our pod letter, and there you will find information on who is our featured guest in that day's podcast, as well as who's going to be coming up next week and suggestions from the archives. So, until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to follow your dreams and do things because they come from your heart. This is Scotty out.